masses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Hello, hello. This is Monkey Wrench.
Bookstore, what?
No. Come in, Bunny Hutch headquarters. It's live from the classic unknown hit, non-hit by Wall of Voodoo called Spy World.
Cool.
Yeah. Great song.
Not familiar with that. I'll have to hear it sometime. Maybe we can play it on the show.
I don't know if it's out there or not, but yeah, Wall of Voodoo, it should be.
Out there? Out from where? Okay, this is Precognitive Dissonance. I'm your host, Miles Lewis, and...
I'm your co-host, Craig York.
Well, you're the host too, dude.
Well, okay, I'm a...
I'm your co-host.
I must be your father. No.
Come over to the dark side?
Well, yes, it is another evening of Precognitive Dissonance here on a Thursday night in Austin, Texas, where the rain is momentarily abated. It'll be back. It always comes back.
At least recently, it seems to just never go away for long.
Easily one of the wettest summers on record.
Hell yeah.
And...
What the hell are we going to talk about?
It's been kind of a... Not exactly a drab week.
There's always stuff going on, whether it's amazingly shocking political scandals or amazingly shocking deaths, amazingly shocking crimes, and amazingly shocking weird.
Oh.
But
well, heading to Betsy, there's a couple of new stuff on the anomalous that I didn't see.
Of course,
today, and you've already looked at them. I have been hearing about colony collapse disorder, which I notice is closed in there.
Yeah, that was one of the news things I was looking at was the Daily
Serious, but they've scientists have isolated a virus that. First appeared in Israel, and I believe it's actually called something like IID, Israel something something.
Really?
But, yes, and I can just...
You can see
the wheels
turning.
In your brain.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Well,
you know, I will say our good pal Greg Bishop wrote an article that won an award for one of the most suppressed... news stories, the tops, the what is it, most censored stories awards that they do every year. Many a year ago, he won an award about how Israel was openly saying they were exploring ethnic weapons.
That's interesting.
Anyway, not that they're the only ones doing it. Cheney, you know, in the last several years has been pushing that. So it's a valid tool. We'll just cleanse our enemies. And then our hands.
Well,
their blood.
You know, that gets into a history of biological warfare, and nobody's used them yet that we know of.
That we know of, yes.
Standard precognitive news disclaimer.
You know,
but not as we know it, Captain.
So some of the other headlines that I was pointing out was, of course, our pal Nick Redfern blogging over at his monsterusa.blogspot.com website. Has blogged about ghostly encounters at the Castle Ring, and I'm sure we'll be hearing a little bit more about that and actually in his new book, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, coming out soon.
Iron Age Hillfort.
He, of course, has been going off about all the Cannock Chase weirdness stuff going on in the woods around there, involving everything from big black dog sightings to Bigfoot sightings to werewolf sightings to UFO sightings more recently. And, oh, here's one. Cassini closes in on Iapetus. Iapetus?
Iapetus. I-A-P-E-T-U-S.
Oh, eek. Iapetus. Saturn watchers on the Cassini mission are preparing for another flyby, this time of the oddly shaped moon.
Iapetus.
This is from theregister.co.uk. I remember there was a lot of controversy about this probe, right, because of its engine. Is it nuclear?
Yes. It's, how I don't understand. I won't say I understand the technology terribly well. It does have nuclear material on board, and I believe it uses, it's not what you would think of as a conventional nuclear rocket engine. Studies for those have been around since the late 50s, and, you know, most of them, very little has been done with them for obvious reasons, even though, you know, technically, they represent the best possibility for space colonization, but that's a debate for another time.
Of course, I'm sure Stan Friedman could tell us all about nuclear-powered rockets, being the resident nuclear physicist.
Very possibly.
Among,
our readers can look up two things, an acronym, NERVA, N-E-R-V-A, and the Orion Project, which is an even more straightforward nuclear engine, if you will. It basically used, it's kind of like a giant nuclear-powered pogo stick. Essentially, there was a large pusher plate supported by heavy pistons at the base of the spaceship, and small nuclear bombs would be ejected behind this plate, which
boom,
would detonate,
boom.
Ram the plate forward, and impart thrust. And I
leaving
think,
a trail of radioactive
signature
for anybody to detect, follow, and
well, it's one of those
take to task.
Nuclear radiation is not generally good for the immediate vicinity. However, if the legacy of Chernobyl is starting to teach us anything, it's that it may not be as hideous as we think. I mean, there's...
I don't know. I've seen some pretty hideous pictures of kids who've been mutated from growing up in and around there. I mean, monstrous.
Well, this is interesting because most of the reports I've read have either downplayed that or, levels of radioactivity in the area are still... you know, dangerously high and inimical to human life, but doesn't seem to be bothering the local wildlife, which is coming back quite nicely.
I probably won't be able to find it that quickly, but I found
that Chernobyl Children Project that was the first link. There's a kid there with hydrocephaly. Looks like the same kid there.
Where are we? Well, it is funny, not funny, haha, funny,
yeah.
Peculiar. I just randomly, you know, picking semi-randomly those two first topics that we led off with, of the bees, a virus, biological warfare, and then talking about nuclear propulsion, kind of reminds, well, and Nick's, and starting off with Nick, Nick's book, Body Snatchers in the Desert, all those themes. Of course, in ironically enough, the UFO literature replete with contact, the contact literature as much as I was going to say the alien abduction literature, the idea that these aliens have hive minds. Anyway, I know it's reaching, but in Body Snatchers in the Desert, we got biological warfare or experimentation,
victims of.
Victims of, and alleged use of those victims in other experiments involving tests of nuclear-powered aircraft, or at least aircraft with piles of nuclear radioactive slag on board, apparently.
Yeah, and that's still one of the parts of Nick's book that I find it a little hard to credit. But
what,
you know,
which part? The idea that there was the atomic plane?
No,
research?
The nuclear airborne nuclear reactor program is fairly well documented.
Okay,
and,
yeah, that's a thought.
Interestingly enough, I'll have to look it up tomorrow. I'm not sure if I could find the link. There's a site that archives old popular technology magazines, things like Popular Mechanics, their contemporaries, Electrical Experimenter, which is a Hugo Gernsback publication.
Mm-hmm.
But not only archives the covers, but also a lot of the contents. And there was an issue from 62 talking about the nuclear-powered bomber. As fairly, well, like most of them, kind of a fluff piece. But it went into surprising detail about a project that I had assumed was at least, you know, if not under the radar, not widely publicized. But then again, I stopped to think about it, and it's kind of like, well, there was a... You know, there were a couple of nuclear-powered bomber models, one Russian, one American, in the late 50s, early 60s. So the idea of nuclear-powered aircraft was certainly wide enough in its dissemination. But, yeah, back to Iapetus. What were we talking about that was so mysterious about it?
About
is that the Death Star moon?
Oh, you know, no, I think that's Io.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Now I'm totally confused.
Well, anyway, yeah, to get back to your original question, there was some controversy about the Cassini probe.
Oh, you bastards.
Yeah.
Dead air is bad, man. We can't
enough,
both be
enough.
We can't both be reading the monitor at the same
well,
time.
Well,
we're looking for this is about the hexagon
mm-hmm.
on Saturday, which I think we talked about recently.
We mentioned it on air a couple of weeks ago.
And
it's one of those, I'm still struck by just the idea of the visual image.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But I'd seen it already back in the early 90s via Richard Hoagland's, that's what I was saying last time, his higher dimensional physics idea, as revealed by the pyramids. And so here's.
Yes, and the Germans are building one.
Yeah, that's just what next great pyramid made in Germany.
It's a charming piece of computer art, which, yeah, okay, and here's the relative scale.
They're proposing to build an even larger Great Pyramid. This is kind of interesting. Last night I had a friend on, Shaggy was on my show, The Blue Rose Report, that I do Wednesday nights, hadn't done one in a long time. And he went off on pyramids and all the pyramid power stuff, and he was actually quoting a lot of stats about it that I was unaware of that were rather fascinating. I forget the one that really blew my mind, but and of course what was the main contention? Well, we can't even do it today. Well, somebody's going to try.
and on a let me just read it to you. The new Great Pyramid, which is estimated would take about 30 years to complete, would be about 1,900 feet tall and 10 times larger than the Great Pyramid of Egypt.
The Great Pyramid has got over 2 million blocks, I think, and there's something about the weight of it that's significant in terms of the weight of the planet, I think. But
I gather that there are quite a number of
strange
findable correlations between various figures, which may or may not have any significance whatsoever.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's an open question, I think, how long these things took to build. There are a lot of assertions that were made, seems like, back in the 60s and 70s and even earlier in the golden age of pyramidology, that have since been at least explained. I think it's only been in the last 25 or 30 years they've actually found the living quarters for the construction crews. So it's one of those. There is, you know, there's plenty of evidence for when they were built, by whom, and in a lot of ways, it makes an awful lot of sense for a pyramid to be the shape it is. It's the simplest, massive structure you can build.
But what about the aliens, man? You've
got a fairly fertile area, which the Nile Valley was, and conditions are relatively benign, which, as far as we can tell, for a couple of thousand years they were, you've got an awful large population because, well, people do tend to reproduce. And, you know, we're talking about an agricultural preliterate society. You want things to stay stable and orderly. What do? You keep people busy. You know,
you're saying that the Great Pyramid was busy work. Idle hands.
Maybe not consciously and deliberately, but I think it may well have served that function.
It's an interesting idea.
It's not to say they're not magnificent, inspiring monuments, you know. But, you know, the notion, well, you know, there's, this has been said by better writers than me, the notion that there were, you know, was some kind of higher intervention in the creation of the pyramids, really kind of belittles human beings, you know. Older, less advanced technologically cultures.
Well, I was talking last night about
older, less technologically advanced cultures.
The epilogue or afterword or whatever it was of the Stargate conspiracy, which is all about the new Egyptology and the Richard Hoagland crowd and the Graham Hancock crowd and their takes on the pyramids' history, the Sphinx's history, and its alleged connections to Mars. And of course, that's what I was, the whole Richard Hoagland higher dimensional physics stuff that predicted the Saturn hexagon. Though, you know, and I got to look back in that book, Stargate Conspiracy, because I'm pretty sure they mention how that specifically, or some several other things that he said predicted stuff that later turned out to be true, had already been known, but like very hardly known. Like most people didn't know it, but it's like, oh, hey, here's a little known fact, and hey, I just discovered something, blah, 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 blah. But the afterword of the book suggested that, okay, you know, let's not go to extraterrestrials for an explanation of how they did something so grandiose that we don't seem to have a good handle on how we would do today. And they talked about the idea that aboriginal cultures that use entheogens seem to have a documentable history of learning things that were really beyond their ken, that were completely beyond their ability to know. But, I mean, they learned it using psychedelics, and how in a variety of psychedelic experiences, the shaman talk about how in those ecstatic states in the distance there's always these cities that look advanced and technological to them, and one of the main features are pyramids. So the suggestion at the end of the Stargate conspiracy was kind of the idea that, well, maybe they, you know, they didn't have extraterrestrials telling them how to build the pyramids. They had sacred psychedelics that just gave them some simple, maybe, or simple to them once they knew how to do it. You know, this the key to how to do something like that. But anyway.
And sounds like something that Devereaux?
There's a number of different researchers who've talked about similar ideas, and
I'm thinking of the Earth Lights writer.
That's Paul Devereaux, yeah.
Paul Devereaux, okay.
Yeah, I was gonna finally.
He's got the book in hand, folks.
Yeah, it's the epilogue, the real Stargate ? And I wanted to remember the author that they cite. Okay, Swiss anthropologist Jeremy Narby. It's his book, The Cosmic Serpent, DNA and the Origins of Knowledge. And it chronicles primitive tribal societies from Siberia to the Amazonian rainforest and how they take shamanic flies out of the body into realms normally inaccessible, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I found it a fascinating idea. And again, it doesn't denigrate the human spirit.
Well, I definitely want to read it when you're ready to hand it over. As you know, I have been putting a modest dent in the shelves of the Anomaly Archives.
Reading a hell of a lot more of the books than I have been able to.
Well, you know, I spend 12 hours a week on a bus. But anyway... one of the things I picked up recently is actually something I've been kind of on and off looking for quite a long time. I first read it in the late 70s. It's a book called The Paranormal by a British psychologist,
Gooch,
and psychic researcher and self-avowed medium, Stan Gooch. And it's just a more like this. Sorry, we're repositioning the mic, and evidently I'm not quite as close to it as I could be. How's that? Anyway, I just got the thumbs up, so I'm free to say whatever I want to. Klaatu, Barada. Anyway.
Shakes head no.
Back to reality. Stan Gooch, The Paranormal. I'm about halfway through it, and it's interesting that in a lot of ways it's very fresh. The only two things that I took away from it or held on to as memories of the book were a strong emphasis on the poltergeist phenomena and a notion that I have not seen mooted too often, and that's that... psychic phenomena may take place in a physical realm which we're simply not able to perceive any other way except psychically. You know, it's one of those, it's a circular argument in some ways, but it also makes a certain amount of sense. What I was surprised by was the amount of skepticism that Gooch shows towards a number of aspects of psychic phenomena. Ghosts, for example, he doesn't believe exists as spirits of the departed. In fact, he's fairly skeptical about their existence, you know, outside the psychological realm at all. I learned a new term, and probably the early term for what's called EVP these days, electronic voice phenomena. He devotes a short chapter to what are called raudive, R-A-U-D-I-V-E, voices, after apparently the original researcher.
I've got a Samizdat copy, Xerox copy of the raudive book that was called Breakthrough. Of course, so did Streber. Later had a book called Breakthrough too. But and is this the one where they were using static television channels? I think that's the preferred method by the people who are carrying on that guy's work. And in fact, I think they've contacted Raw Div himself.
May have because I can remember that concept showing up when I was reading a little background on it a while back. But he basically, the last word in that chapter is rubbish. and I found myself thinking about it because, ooh la la.
That's Raw Div. No,
Raw Div, a.k.a. Oliver Ho, live at Dansu Techno Club. A lot of Raw Div out there.
Constantine, though.
But I think we're talking about Constantine Raw Div, who looks a little like George Burns in that thumbnail there. But anyway, I found myself wondering if anyone had ever attempted the experiment with a perhaps like a tape player running over the record head with no external microphone. It's one of the things I've noticed about EVP is that these things are set up just as, you know, a standard recorder. The Ghost Hunters television program is the best example I can think of off the top of my head. They just use a standard little digital recorder of some kind. And I found myself thinking, you know, the thing about, as I understand it, and again, my experience is largely with watching it on Ghost Hunters, these auditory phenomena are not generally perceived at the time they're recorded.
Right.
Yeah. And I find myself wondering if anyone has ever conducted an experiment with a recording device with the, you know, input completely cut out of the circuit, with only the medium running over the recording device itself.
Not to my knowledge. Hmm. It's an interesting idea. You're also talking about using tape as opposed to, say, a strictly digital recording device. Either way, I mean, I think the principle is so ill-defined regarding the idea of getting messages from the beyond.
Yeah.
It's like anything seems possible, and if something works better than others, then if one way works better than another way, then it's hard to grok whether, you know, is it a result of, you know, okay, there really is a spirit realm and it's just easier for them to do this than that, or is it, again, as most skeptics would think, an artifact of the technology. And that by doing something like that, you take the phenomena out of the picture, and so you might not get anything. I don't know. But I think that as much as I think there's a real phenomena there, I think that experiment would probably prove that you could do it several ways and that that's not necessary. But I bet you would still get the
reason
messages.
I would suggest tape and... I admit, this is a reason that occurs to me after the suggestion. But it basically, you know, establishing some kind of parameters for the experiment. There's a suggestion that ghosts are, in some aspects, an electromagnetic phenomenon. And digital recording... Well, I'm not exactly sure where the recording occurs, so I'm not sure that it's a specifically electromagnetic process, whereas I know that standard open reel and cassette tape is a directly electromechanical process or electrochemical. The tape passes over the record head. The varying charge in the record head changes the alignment of the iron molecules, the ferrous molecules in the tape, and preserves the signal that way. Yeah,
but with digital, I'm not sure how exactly that works. I mean,
presumably the signal is going to the hard drive,
right? And the hard drive's the hard drive is more or less the same thing as the magnetic tape head, only a spinning disc. But the thing is, with these little flash drives that most like MP3 recorders and cameras and stuff are using, there's no moving part there. It's not even an old school antiquated idea of the spinning disc.
Well, it's just an instance of a simple current flow. It's really nothing
which
more
is electromagnetic,
than an on-off switch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know, like, it seems like with the orb phenomena and other modern aspects of ghost hunting.
Funny you should mention that.
That there, there does seem to be a preference for digital medium instead of old school analog cameras. There's a good example probably. And the same, I think, with the rods.
Oh, words. Yes, the rods, the skyfish, the bugs.
Oh, that just reminds me of a part of a dream I had last night. Part of the dream involved being in a really upscale lodge on the side of a steep mountain with a huge valley ravine below, and part of it involved being outdoors nearby, kind of that ski lodge feel of the local environment, but like being near a creek and there's some water running over some things that are exposing like possibly an ancient structure, and the POV shifts to where I'm looking at the characters and the lay of the land behind them, and I slowly, as me as the perceiver, notice that the land behind them is part of the structure that's being revealed, and lo and behold, it's starting to rise up out of the ground like some buried transformer robot. Only the shape of it, once in the next series of shots that show it floating up into the air and being flown around as if it's a craft, is that of kind of like a centipede meets a silverfish, and also meets a crop circle glyph, like, you know.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You have the best damn dreams.
I have some good ones when I can remember them, yeah.
Color or black and white?
Color.
Yeah. I'm doubly envious.
And the only time I dream in black and white is if I'm watching an old scratchy film.
Yeah.
And I like being able to occasionally change the POV. That's nice. Like a film. I've been in a dream and actually been able to rewind and change the angle of the camera so that I could see what was some previously obscured sexual imagery on the beautiful females that were in the scene. It's like camera pans by and all their special parts are obscured by branches of a tree. So I rewind in the dream, change the angle a little, and oh, voila, I can see everything I wanted to see.
Oh, dear.
Play that back. New angle. X-rated.
That's more lucid than I think I want to dream.
Actually, I don't even know how lucid I was in that moment when that happened in that dream. So actually, I should correct that. It's not like I can do that on demand, but it's happened in a couple of dreams, and actually in those I don't think I was actually lucid. Oh well. So. Yeah, I think you nodded at this earlier.
Yes, you've picked up. I can't remember. Is it a documentary or is it?
It's a documentary.
Yeah, Marjo.
About Marjo Gortner.
And I know you've mentioned the name before. I can vaguely remember a review of this in either Time or Newsweek when I was in high school. All I know about him is that he was a former child evangelist who eventually became very disenchanted with his role in life. But he's since gone on to something of significance in the paranormal community, but I can't remember what, or has he?
I'm not sure about that last part. Marjo Gortner, I first heard of him because he is in the wonderful, awesome B-movie Star Crash, The Adventures of Stella Star.
Yes, yes, yes.
He plays the Luke Skywalker amalgam character who has, you know, psychic power, Jedi powers, and he can make weird lights appear in his hand, and he wields a lightsaber.
Well, I'm only going to watch it for Carolyn Monroe, but, you know.
Yeah, she's awesome. Of course, my good friend Stephen Romano has written an amazing expose on the making of that movie that has yet to be released, mainly because he thinks that he'd probably be killed if he wrote everything that he's learned. It's a really...
Got a copy of the manuscript?
An old version of it laying around somewhere, but I can get a newer version. But anyway, he turned me on to Star Crash and then turned me on to this movie, Marjo. And so Marjo Gortner, yeah, I come across him as this science fiction actor from this Italian science fiction film with, what's the...
Isn't David Hasselhoff also?
David Hasselhoff is in it. And with a Western talking robot. I forget.
I've never actually seen the film.
Oh, my God. It's awesome. You absolutely have to see it. It's one of the most beautifully colorful B-movies you'll ever see. It's got, what's the stop-motion animation guy?
Not Ray Harryhausen.
Ray Harryhausen. It's got Ray Harryhausen-styled animation.
Ah, okay.
Actually, it may actually, I think it's him. I forget. I'm such a...
Are you sure you're not thinking of Flesh Gordon?
No.
Okay.
I've actually still never seen that. But, so... My friend turns me on to Marjo, and this documentary, basically, yeah, you're saying he's a child prodigy evangelist. Basically, his parents were, you know, classic evangelist hucksters who traveled around, did the whole tent revival kind of thing, and basically, when they had their kid, they recognized his actor abilities and... turned him into a little preacher child. I mean, it's really amazing to watch him preach. It's just fascinating to see this little kid going off and doing that weird lilt that evangelists do. The Holy Spirit! drawing out those words. And basically he went away from them for a long time, and then he comes back with a film crew who are going to expose him. I mean, I don't know the whole story. Maybe there's more to it than is exposed in the film. But as far as you can tell, he's just, you know, I mean, I don't know if maybe he just did it for his career. I don't know. But he goes back to basically because he says he's tired of them, you know, huckstering people. And so they're going to infiltrate and expose them. And it's pretty powerful, but it's been a long time since I saw it. So, borrowed a copy from my friend Steve, from the back.
It's available on DVD, apparently.
Yeah, the back says, "The Academy Award-winning Marjo is the ferocious and extraordinary chronicle of a firebrand evangelical preacher who wholeheartedly and humorously exposed himself as a fraud. An evangelist prodigy at the age of 4, the film captures an adult Marjo as he recounts how he discovered the seductions of the 60s counterculture and dropped out of preaching, only to return later using his swaggering bravado to woo Pentecostal audiences out of their offerings." Directors Howard Smith and Sarah Kernachan follow Marjo as he embarks on his Farewell to the Faith tour, revealing the secrets of religious hucksterism, a fiery baptism in the cynical waters of faith healing and evangelical fervor. Marjo is a fascinating profile of a man who went from hellfire to hellraising. Indeed. I don't see a copyright date on this. 72, I guess. 1972.
Yeah, I knew it was a ways back there. That also is, interestingly, one of the things that Gooch does find as somewhat credible is faith healing. Not exactly faith healing, but psychic healing. The laying on of hands. And cites a number of studies done at the time. This is the early to mid-70s. But also comes down hard on fraudulent psychic healers. It's interesting. I remember Arrigo, the surgeon of the Rusty Knife, because my parents were long-time Reader's Digest subscribers, and I distinctly remember the book was abridged in Reader's Digest, and that's where I became familiar with it. And I, you know,
you're talking about John Fuller and his
right,
books last
and
week. Yeah.
That was one of those. I saw that and went, and he wrote that too, which I have a vague recollection of as being essentially a fairly positive and apparently uncritical work. And Arrigo and others like him were subsequently fairly roundly debunked.
Usually by the likes of James Randi.
Well, just because the man's a jerk doesn't mean he's always wrong.
No, that's... as long as we can agree that he's a jerk.
And,
James the unamusing Randi.
You know, he is not the only magician to... I saw a striking demonstration of the technique on a program by a guy named Chris Angel, who's kind of a heavy metal magician.
Right.
So, you know, I find myself now going, great, you know, did he just drop the ball on one? Or does this call into question all of Fuller's books? You know, it's one of those, how critical was he? How... You know, hard did he look at things?
Andrea Puterich, apparently I investigated one of those guys. It may have even been Arrigo, but he investigated one or two psychic surgeons, and I think similarly was deluded or gullible or deliberately promoted them and thought that that was the next wave in you know, health, alternative healing. And I think there's a lot to various psychic healing and alternative healing and laying on of hands and various other techniques that are actually can be quite effective. But, again, are they any more effective than the placebo effect? That's a big question. Or can they be, you know, combined with a number of other techniques?
Gooch seems to think they are. You've touched on something else that I wanted to bring up, and most of the stuff that I've been borrowing from you, from the Anomaly Archives, has been written in the 70s. It's stuff that I didn't get around to at the time, or, as in the case of the paranormal, I'm rereading for the first time in 30 years. The other thing that struck me is the ubiquity of Geller and Puerich. I'd say a good two-thirds of the books I've read from the period so far, Geller has been mentioned and almost invariably in company with Puerich.
Well, this is the import of the Stargate conspiracy and the import of Puerich and how he wanted no less than to, you know, overthrow the prevailing paradigm and get to these new paradigms that were implied by everything he was learning about parapsychology and psychic phenomena. And one of the researchers right over there is an article called The Stargate Conundrum, which is a lengthy essay by one of the I can't pronounce words correctly, so
oh, okay. Well, conundrum. I just corrected Miles's pronunciation. It's conundrum, and that's from a man who pronounced paradigm as paradigm up until about 6 years ago.
That's okay. Everybody does it some one way or the other. And that, again, well, anyway. So this book, or rather this essay, is by one of the research assistants on Stargate conspiracies. Not conspiracy. He's not the one of the two authors, but he is credited as being one of their main researchers. And he has a very different idea about the nature of the Stargate conspiracy and the evidence that they uncovered. And his basic premise is that what was being looked for and suppressed is the psychic drug. What, you know, is there a way to make people more psychic and to increase their ability? Or and he keeps coming back to that theory, the idea that that Andrea Perhorich was working for the military and looking for a psychic drug, and that's why things like DMT and others have been outlawed. And but he goes into great detail. He and the authors of Stargate Conspiracy go into great detail about the history of Perhorich and how seminal and at the core of so many of the 70s New Age paradigm shift movement he was, and he contacted and influenced so many. I mean, and went on to influence those. He influenced those who went on to influence millions more people in subtle and not so subtle ways. I mean, Gene Roddenberry is a great example of somebody who came within that sphere of influence and saw some of the weird shit going on, and ended up, you know, at least writing about it. But he got scared off, you know, and it's fascinating stuff. Just fascinating.
Damn it, Miles, I want answers.
Not more questions?
Miles doesn't really have pointy ears, friends. and I, unfortunately, have not had half the green-skinned women in the galaxy. But, you know, anyway.
Anywho, so there's some other interesting headlines out there. Traced, the asteroid breakup that wiped out the dinosaurs. They're now saying that a couple of rocks collided in the asteroid belt, showering down debris on the planet Earth, and setting evolution back or forward millions of years, depending upon how you look at it. Paris, the extinction of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago can be traced to a collision between two monster rocks in the asteroid belt nearly 100 million years earlier, scientists report on Wednesday. Smash drove a giant sliver of rock into Earth's path, eventually causing the climate-changing impact that ended the reign of the dinosaurs and enabled the rise of mammals, including, eventually, us. Hmm. Or is it all just a simulation?
Well, you know, they've gotten fairly good at, tracing orbital paths back. That's a long ways back, but I gather what they're doing is modeling a particular large asteroid in the belt. And apparently determined that...
Across.
You know, well, you know, it's one of those things. There's a related article, I believe it's, again, through the Anomalous, that a number of dinosaurs may have actually survived the Great Extinction event by some several million years.
It has to happen every single show now.
And the devil lives in my husband's body. That's one we ought to look up. UFOs attacking Ukraine. Sorry. Yeah, I'm just, you know.
It's my mom. She has never... Hey, Mom, you should be listening to the show instead of calling me. No, you should call me more often so I don't have to call during your show.
Well, anyway, let's look in on things cryptozoological. There's Once again, old blue skin. Yes, El Chupacabra is back in the news again. Sources say no one's interested in. Nobody. No, I'm sorry. That's an old Saturday Night Live bit that I'm not going to steal too much more from. You just flashed on it, and I'm kind of excited because the headline was new ivory-billed photographs from the was it Florida, I think?
I didn't see that at all. Where was it?
I think it's the very top headline on Cryptomundo.
Well,
you know. I'm a whole lot of help. Yes, Florida's ivory-billed photographed. And, oop, that's an ivory-billed woodpecker, all right.
1935.
Okay. Well, we can get into the story later, but that's very encouraging. After getting a small grant, Hill and several of his colleagues traveled to the Florida Panhandle in January 2007. And there's a quote below. Also published a paper detailing the evidence they found supporting the existence of ivory-billed woodpeckers along the Choctawhatchee River in Florida. Hill's pursuit of better photographic evidence continues. We just haven't gotten a really good break yet in getting photos of this bird, but it does exist. Okay. Well, that's positive and encouraging news. I mean, the photograph at the head of the article is, you know, very clear and very distinct, but I gather these are fairly magnificent birds. You know,
pretty damn
large. not huge.
I mean, well, hey, they're bigger than the ones I saw in Arkansas.
I like that.
Yes, indeedy. And here's what we were talking about just a second ago. Even scientific tests might not quell chupacabra mania. Texas's favorite mysterious devil beast is back. I don't know when it became the state's favorite mysterious devil beast.
Yeah, they didn't pull me on that one.
I didn't get a call. But, you know, once again, another blue-skinned, blue-tinted canoid.
So the suggestion is coming up now that it's one of the, it's just a hairless dog variety.
Mangy coyote. Supposedly has outsized fangs and, you know, this is one of those head-scratching, it's kind of like you find yourself thinking, people keep dismissing it, but they also keep reporting it.
Hey, you know? There's obviously something to it. I mean, there's one after the other being found. What the hell are they? It should be simple enough to figure out. It's not like, you know... it's not like guys going to Texas Parks and Wildlife and saying, hey, I saw, you know, a black puma in my backyard. Sure you did, buddy. Sure you did. Yeah. Did you get pictures, too?
Or a 30-foot-long monitor lizard.
Where?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
And, of course, these things look, you know, virtually nothing like the...
fabled chupacabra. Oh!
The Puerto Rico reports, especially. He's got something.
Did you see the thing about that Ken Thomas sent to Lauren Coleman about the chupacabra?
I don't think so.
Oh, well, dang it. Why ain't I finding it? Ken Thomas, who's a parapolitical researcher of much repute. He does steamshovelpress.com, where he publishes a parapolitical magazine called Steam Shovel Press. And, man. He sent Lauren Coleman at cryptomundo.com information on the possibility of the word chupas going back to, I think, the 30s.
I remember the series now.
Chupacabras, 1951. Kenneth Thomas, editor of Steam Shovel Press and Missouri University Archivist, shares an old reference to what seems like a new occurrence of chupacabras in a sinister context, which he found on August 23rd, 2007. And it's in the film
Bride of the Gorilla with Raymond Burr and Lon Chaney. I gotta get got it. Netflix. Where's my Netflix account? And it involves. I don't remember now. Burr gets poisoned by a witch and either starts becoming a gorilla or it's all in his mind and he's running around naked at night in a South American jungle. The natives are convinced that it's a legendary beast called something like a sucaris. It was hard to tell from the dialect. When they describe the legendary beast, they are quite clearly describing a chupacabra. The verbal descriptions were a match. When they decide to set a trap for it, they use a live goat as bait. They do bring a goat to the trap that they set for the creature. And this actually started a very interesting thread where folks were chiming in about other possible occurrences of said.
And I believe the gentleman who writes the Forget Amori blog made some very pertinent observations.
Who knows what they are? I can't remember what his handle is, but yeah.
Ah, oh. I think that's it, actually. The one just above Photo Expert there, T. Peter.
The person says, "Dear Lauren, the South American natives in the movie calling the metamorphosized Raymond Burr and Monster Something sounding like Sucaris could be a garbled pronunciation of Chupacabras. However, it also reminded me of Sucareth, a longer or extended form of Sioux, a legendary Patagonian cryptid noted for supposedly devouring its young rather than letting them be captured." And it goes on and on. Anyway, well, hey, it's just about the top of the hour. There was this other thing I was I haven't had the chance to read this whole article, but
yeah.
Persistence of myths could alter public policy approach. What the hell? Washington Post staff writer saying that the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have issued a flyer to combat myths about the flu vaccine. But if I remember correctly, there was some very interesting ideas yielded from this. The psychological insights yielded by the research, which had been confirmed in a number of peer-reviewed laboratory experiments, have broad implications for public policy. The conventional response to myths and urban legends is to counter bad information with accurate information. But the new psychological studies show that denials and clarifications, for all their intuitive appeal, can paradoxically contribute to the resiliency of popular myths. Which kind of gets to the heart of cognitive dissonance, doesn't it?
yeah, and this is actually something that I had seen. I think it was a different story, but essentially the import is the same. That people tend to remember false statements as true, not necessarily vice versa, but that essentially proving something wrong or untrue seems to flip-flop in people's minds after a while, which is damned odd.
Well, I know that for years I've used words thinking they meant one thing, and it turned out they meant exactly the opposite. Much to the detriment of my credibility.
Miles, having a wonderful time in Spain, wish you were here. P.S. Bordello does not mean train station.
I thought it meant bathroom.
Oh, that's from an old Mad magazine. Still one of my favorites.
All right, guys.
Because I didn't get it for about 5 years. I was young. Yes, it's 7:59. We're just about off the air and out of time for this week's Precognitive Dissonance. But please join us next week and drop into our website, www.precognitivedissonance.com.
Also, you can now email us at precog@precognitivedissonance.com. Dissonance.com. That's precog, P-R-E-C-O-G, at precognitivedissonance.com. So
damn straight.
Damn straight.
This is Greg, by God, York.
And Smiles, what the... Lewis, signing off. Have a great night. Thanks for listening.
Keep watching the skies.